It is that time now once again, for getting lumped up with my friends. It's Rock a Mike and Rob that you should know, and you'll find them here on the Rock Show. Ooh, yeah, on the Rock Show.
Episode 131 of the Rock Show.
All right.
We're moving to episode 150 by the end of the year. We should probably hit 150.
Yep, we'll have a big show for that whenever that falls. I'm not sure yet.
Yep.
So we're talking about the making of this album, The Who's Quadrophenia. It was released October 26, 1973 on Track Records.
Yeah.
It was recorded in kind of different sessions. They recorded between May and June of 1972 with some very early demos, and then again they got into the studio between May and September of 1973.
Why did that happen?
Well, what happened was, I was going to mention it is they were building a new studio, okay, which was called Ramport. So The May and June in 72 sessions were done at Olympic in London. Ooh. All right, a very popular studio. A lot of people have recorded there. And they were building their own studio specifically to record this album. The Who didn't have their own studio at this point. They knew that it would take a lot of overdubbing, a lot of mixing to get this album right. And they wanted to have their own studio. What happened is there was Townsend who wrote this entire record.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It's the only Who record that is totally attributed to him. Okay. And he was dealing with that, writing the record, coming up with ideas. The other three guys were working on solo projects. Daltrey had a solo album, Entwistle had a solo album, and Moon was doing some he was filming a movie called That'll Be the Day. Okay. He's in that briefly, and he was recording some of his own stuff. He was doing his own thing. So there was kind of like a break where Townsend had a chance to really write this thing the way he wanted. And they realized they had to use a 16-track recording studio to get this right. So what they ended up using was Ronnie Lane from The Faces and The Small Faces. He had a mobile studio in a truck that was his own. And they borrowed that. He let them borrow it. So in 72, it was kind of a slow period, all right, for them. Between 69 and 70, Tommy was a big success. It really broke the band heavily in the United States at that point. They did a big U.S. tour.
Yeah, that was fantastic.
Right at the end of that, they recorded live at Leeds. Remember we talked about the live album?
Yeah, very good album.
Right. Now, what happened next was there was a project that Townsend had called a Lifehouse. And it was supposed to be an album, a concept kind of album. And it kind of fell apart. But it would morph into the highly successful Who's Next album.
Yep.
Okay. That came out in 71. They were really looking to capitalize further on these recent successes. So Pete Townsend decided to write a second rock opera. Okay. They had Tommy. They said, let's revisit this kind of idea again. And they were going to come up with something, but he wasn't sure yet at that point. They had recorded some new material in the spring of 72 in those sessions in May and June before the Quadrophenia concept had really gelled. Okay, they had a song called Is It In My Head and Love Rain Over Me. Okay, that was recorded at that time. Now, originally, the idea that he was thinking of was to be called Long Live Rock, Rock Is Dead. Okay. And if you remember, that's the Long Live Rock is from Who's Next, that song. Okay. But they were going to make a rock opera kind of in that theme. But Townsend kind of thought it was too derivative of Who's Next. Let's go in a different direction. Daltrey, Entwistle, and Moon, like I said, were off doing solo things. So he had time to come up with this concept of Quadrophenia. He met up with this guy. He was an original Who fan from way back. His name was Irish Jack Lyons. okay? And he was one of the original Who fans from when they used to be called the High Numbers in the mod days of the early 60s in England. And they, you know, it made Townsend kind of get the idea to create a story based on those old mod scene days, okay? And so we came up with this idea of a character named Jimmy, okay, which was really kind of a mix of six different early Who fans. One of them was Lyons himself. The plot would be about the band's early history and the audiences and about Jimmy in particular.
Yeah.
All right? Now, the plot would kind of center on Jimmy, who was a young working class mod who likes drugs, girls, and beating up rockers. Okay. Now, there was the whole, you know, Americans may not know so much about this, but in England, in the early 60s, you had two rival youth scenes going on. There was the rockers, which was the guys that were into rockabilly and early rock and roll from the 50s. And then you had the mods, and they were the stuff that were into, like, the Who, the Kinks, this British Invasion stuff that was out there. They liked a lot of soul music out of America. Okay. I mean, there's a great scene in Quadrophenia in the movie where, you know, they're all dancing and like the Do Run Run is on. You know, remember we talked to Lala Brooks yeah. about that? And I remember asking her if she saw Quadrophenia and she said she had. So that was cool. But so that's what the mod scene and the rockers, they were rivals. They used to fight, big street fights between these two groups. So Jimmy becomes a fan of The Who after seeing them live in Brighton. But his parents have a kind of a disillusioned attitude towards him. They just don't care about him. And he has had a series of dead-end jobs that haven't worked out. And he even went to the psychiatrist one time, and it didn't work out for him. He's totally kind of fucked up in the head, all right? Not to mention he's doing a lot of drugs, which in those days, okay, a lot of speed. His parents gave him a hard time about all this amphetamine use that he was doing. And he ends up taking a job as a garbage man for 2 days, but it doesn't work out. And he begins to kind of doubt himself if he's even worth anything. So he enjoys being a mod, but his life within the scene is very difficult. And his girlfriend even leaves him for his best friend.
Yeah.
So,
totally.
So he goes down to Brighton where, you know, he's reminded of good times. And he spots Ace Face, who's the leader of the mods, working as a bellboy at a hotel. Now, Ace Face was a mod that they all looked up to. All right. It's funny that he's called Ace Face, because if you were called the face, if you were considered a face in the mod scene, you were a leader. Okay. So if you were a leader of these groups, you were called a face. The Who used to, when they were called the High Numbers, they used to have a song called I'm the Face. Okay. And so this guy is Ace Face. So he's like the head face of all the faces. All right. And he's spotted by Jimmy working as a bellboy, and it just kind of like bursts his bubble. Like he just believes now that everything sucks in his life. He's rejected by everything that, you know, he thought he liked, he thought he knew. And he contemplates taking his own life. He ends up going out to sea. There's like a cliff, and he's on the cliff with a scooter. And, you know, in the film, you really get a good depiction of this at the very end of the movie. And you kind of don't know what happens. Like at the end of the movie and in the concept of the album, you don't know either. Does he kill himself or not? Okay, I kind of figured he always did, but you don't know. Okay, so this is some pretty deep stuff, you know, that Townsend was going to be writing here. He wanted to give Jimmy a four-way split personality. And that leads to the title, Quadrophenia, because it's kind of a play on schizophrenia, like twice as worse. Okay, so it's Quadrophenia. So the writing of Quadrophenia had some additional delays as an orchestral version of Tommy was worked on with producer Lou Reisner. and the solo projects that were being done with Moon and Whistle and Daltrey. Now, shockingly at this time, The Who, and particularly Daltrey, discovered that managers Kit Lambert and Chris Stamp had large sums of money unaccounted for. So they were getting ripped off by their management.
Mm. All right?
And Lambert was also their producer. Okay, so Daltrey wanted them fired right away. Okay, and at first, Townsend resisted this. So Townsend said, no, not yet. Okay, but Daltrey was fed up because he knew he was getting ripped off. Both of these guys would actually be fired by 1974. Okay, and a settlement about these missing funds would be worked out over a few years after that.
Oh, but so they recovered the funds, right?
It was like they ended up recovering it in like royalties and like different ways of paying back, like reworking contracts so they get more of a percentage. The money was gone. Both these guys, Lambert was fucked up on drugs. Okay, so he was kind of, and a lot of alcohol. So he was probably drinking and drugging it away. And yeah, you weren't going to get that money back in any real way. So they ended up getting it just by, you know, getting more points in their contract. So in November of 72, the group decided to build their own studio. Like I mentioned, it was called Ramport Studios in the Battersea area of London. But by early 73, they still lacked an adequate mixing board that could handle the recording that they needed to do for Quadrophenia.
Yes.
So instead, Ronnie Lane of Small Faces and The Faces lent them his truck, and Kit Lambert began producing the album in May. But due to his drug problems and tensions within the band, he was really unreliable. Okay? So his production services were called off at Roger Daltrey's demand. All right, he said, you know, we're not using you as a producer. But he was kept on for another year, but in like a very limited capacity. So the band recruited engineer Ron Nevison, who had worked with Townsend's associate John Alcock, to assist with the producing. So they bring in Nevison. To illustrate the four-way split personality of Jimmy, Townsend wrote four themes reflecting the four members of The Who. Okay, these were The Bellboy, which reflected Moon. Yep. Is It Me, which reflected John Entwistle. Helpless Dancer, which reflected Daltrey. And Love Rain Over Me, which was for Townsend. So two lengthy instrumentals on the album, the title track, Quadrophenia, and the rock, a song called The Rock, contain parts of the four themes separately. In other words, you hear pieces of those songs in there.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, these instrumentals, they're very interesting because they were never demoed, okay, but they were kind of built up in the studio. All right, they were strictly put together in the studio. They never demoed these things. It just was kind of invented on the fly.
Wow. Right?
And many people that, you know, have written about The Who and studied The Who claim that these instrumentals were some of the most ambitious music that they ever recorded. And I kind of agree because it really was taking things to a different level. And it works, these instrumentals work so well in Quadrophenia. What I love about Quadrophenia, I got to mention too, is it's cohesive. I feel Tommy is not as cohesive. Like, Tommy's great, and when they played it from the first song to the last song, which they would do that with Quadrophenia pretty much as well when they played it live. But I find that Tommy, you could pick pieces out of it, and they're good songs. But there's things in there that just don't gel the way Quadrophenia does. So, like, these instrumentals with the pieces of the other songs in it, it kind of tells the story. And you know, you get it a lot easier. So, most of the tracks that were involved in each of the group recordings, they recorded the parts separately, okay? And that was unlike earlier Who albums. They didn't do that in the past. They worked together. But for this, they did their parts separately. And what Townsend had done is when he wrote and recorded some of these demos for these songs, he left a lot of room in there for the band members to contribute different things. It was never like, okay, here's the demo, you got to do it just like this. It was like, no, there's room for improvement and adding to. So really, Townsend wrote the record, but there's definite involvement with the other members as well. And that was intentional.
Well, he probably did. He mixed it in later on. You know, he added this. He put that where he needed to put
yeah,
it
and
in.
And since they were working a little bit separately, they were able to come up with their own ideas and present it to him. And, you know, if it fit good, he would use it. So it was very democratically done, I guess you could say, you know. So
I got to tell you, it's a hell of an album, because when you hear the album, it's goddamn great rock and roll. It's great rock and roll.
It's, I mean, think of the songs on there.
Yeah.
All right. I mean, you know, The Real Me. I mean,
great song.
That's a fucking one of the best Who songs ever. And I mean, the bass lines on that are just amazing. Yeah. You know, now, most of the synthesizers that you hear on the finished album came from what was called an ARR 2500 synthesizer. And it was recorded at Townsend's home. Okay. The only song arranged by the band in the studio was actually 515. Okay, that was all done in the studio. But everything was kind of done in different places. Yeah, that was the first single off it in England, and that's a song that they, to this day, still do. You know, and you still hear it on the radio. Okay. Did I say the ARR 2500? It's called an ARP 2500.
Yeah, ARP.
Yeah, my mistake. The problem with the ARP 2500 is that it was impossible to record it in the studio. It was difficult to change sounds on it, okay, because there was something called a patch that wasn't always available. It really kind of required that Townsend, who was really the expert on the thing. I mean, you got to remember, synthesizers coming out, they'd been around, but they really weren't used in rock music. And, you know, what he was doing was breaking ground with this stuff. And he was good at working on this thing, but he tended to work alone at night on these synthesizer parts, because at home he could really get it right. In the studio, for some reason, there was some kind of hindrance to it. He just had a problem. So he also needed to obtain a good string section sound. Okay, you have to have like an orchestral sound. So what he did was he bought a cello, an actual cello, and he learned how to play it. And within a two-week period, he was pretty good at it. So he was recording the violin parts, really cello parts, I should say, string parts for himself. So John Entwistle, bass player, recorded his bass parts to The Real Me in one take. That's hard to believe. He used a Gibson Thunderbird bass and spent several weeks during the summer of 73 working on the multi-track horn parts as well. If you remember, John Entwistle could play horn. He played French horn, okay, in some songs by The Who, early songs they have a French horn. So, but I'm blown away by the fact that he did the bass lines to The Real Me in one take.
Yeah, that's pretty good, man.
Incredible. Yeah, it really is. Now, having been forced to play more straightforwardly on Who's Next, Keith Moon returned to his wilder kind of established style that he had for Quadrophenia. Yeah. He contributed the lead vocals on the song Bellboy, where he delivered his vocals in like a very exaggerated kind of style.
Yeah.
During Love Rain Over Me, Moon ends up kicking over a set of tubular bells for the finale of the song, and you can actually hear it in the final mix. It's like a big crash, and that was him kicking over the bells. But during the album's production, Townsend made many field recordings with a portable reel-to-reel recorder. He would record rain washing on the beach. He recorded the whistle of a diesel train engine as it neared his own house. Nevison did some recording. He would record a marching band perform the John Philip Sousa march The Thunderer, which is used at the end of the song Dirty Jobs.
Yeah.
Now, assembling the field recordings in the studio was problematic at times. At one point during the song I Am the Sea, there were 9 tape machines running in the studio with different sound effects all at the same time. Okay, so it probably got pretty crazy in that studio. Now, according to Nevison himself, Townsend really produced the album single-handedly, even though he's given credit for it. But he said that everything started when Pete got there in the morning and finished when Pete left at night. All right. So Townsend began mixing the album in August of 73 at his home studio with the help of Nevison as well. Prior to the album's release, 515 was released as a single in the UK, and The Who did a live appearance on the Top of the Pops TV show on October 4th, 1973. And the song was released as a single the next day. The song reached number 20 in the charts in the UK, and there were some issues when the album was released itself on October 26th in the UK. It turns out there was a, if you remember, in the early 70s, we had an oil embargo crisis.
Yeah, because the prices were crazy.
Right, right. Well, what that also affected was vinyl. Okay? Vinyl's made out of petroleum.
Yeah.
There was a shortage of it. And it was hard to find this record a little bit when it came out. There was a shortage of actual production numbers until they could get it all worked out. But despite that, the album still got to number 2 in the UK. Okay? The only thing that was holding it out of the number 1 spot was David Bowie's Pinups album.
Wow.
And in America, it only got to number 2 as well. You know what held it back?
Who?
Elton John's Goodbye Yellow Brick Road album. All right. So those two, those were monster albums, Pinups and, well, Pinups was big in the UK. It wasn't as big here. But Goodbye Yellow Brick Road was a huge album for Elton John. So,
yeah.
In the US, 515 wasn't the first single. It was Love Rain Over Me. All right, and that was released October 27th of 73. Now, the album was...
But this album had a few singles that came out.
I think it was just the 2.
I think, wasn't The Real Me released as a single?
Don't think so. No, not in if it was, it might have been somewhere else, but not in the US or the UK. But that's a song that radio picked up on.
Yeah, it was like The Real Me and Dr. Jimmy.
As a single, it might be, okay. All right, did you look that up? It might be.
Yeah, there
okay.
was only there was these are the there was 515 and Water.
Yeah,
released in the UK October 5th,
and then The Real Me in the UK
Then in the US, check this out. In the US, they released Love Rain Over Me.
Right, that was the first
October 27th.
Right.
And then the last one was on January 12, 1974, The Real Me and Dr. Jimmy.
Yeah, okay, good, good. I'm glad you corrected me there. And it's still a radio hit. Okay, you still hear it on classic rock stations.
Yeah,
you know.
Ain't that weird that they took those songs and released single? It's a whole rock album and you release a single. I think that's weird, you know that?
You mean because you're only getting like a little piece of it?
Yeah, that's what I mean. I find it weird.
Yeah. I don't know if, how much did The Who have to do with marketing it? You know, they might have just made this record and then didn't have a lot to do with what was coming out as the singles. I mean, The Real Me was a great song. It's one of my favorite Who songs.
It's a good single,
and it holds on to stand out on the album. But when you release a single in a rock opera, you're only getting a little piece of what you're doing. You know what they were doing. So yeah,
but my think about it, they didn't release The Real Me until like 1974 by itself.
Well, the album came out at the end of the year, so they probably needed an extra. Maybe sales were dropping; they needed an extra push for the album. Sometimes a single will do that.
That makes sense.
Yeah, sometimes they'll do that, or they used to do that. But originally the album was released as a 2-record set in a gatefold album that opened up, and there was a booklet inside that had all the lyrics. Okay, it had kind of a page explaining the story, giving like a text of the story, kind of like I did at the beginning of the podcast.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of photographs taken by Ethan Rosewell. Okay. That's the picture of the guy on the bike with the Who jacket and everything like that. So in the decades since the album has been re-released and remastered a bunch of times, there was a great 5-CD deluxe box set that came out in 2011. It included several different mixes, and it also came with a disc of outtakes, because there were a few songs that were not, that were recorded that were not used. All right. And one thing too, that if there's anything to complain about this album, and I'm not sure if I totally agree with it, is in the original mix, some people felt that Daltrey's vocals were a little too low, a little bit too far down in the mix.
Wow.
I never really thought that. And I did have the album, you know, I do have the album as vinyl from the original mix, okay? Obviously, I didn't buy it in 73, but I probably bought it in 81 maybe or something like that on vinyl. And, you know, I still have it. And I never felt the mix was bad. But that's always, you know, these people, these critics and people with their ideas with the mixes, I almost never agree with them.
No, but I thought this mix was very good, man.
I mean, now it's very crisp. It's very clear.
Yeah.
You know, if you get it now, it's totally remastered. I mean, I think this is like a Desert Island disc. You know, everybody should have this fucking record, you know, as far as I'm concerned. But critically, when it came out, it was well received. All right. Like I said, the only critical thing might have been the mix. But both sides of the Atlantic, in the UK and America, the critics loved the album. And right away, the band began a tour in support of it. Okay, but
you want to do something funny, Mike?
What's that?
They did a lot better when Kiss tried to do a rock opera.
What do you mean, like The Elder?
Yeah, The Elder was such a shit.
The Elder was shit.
Was shit.
Yeah, I mean,
but that was his, you know, that was like Gene Simmons' vision of like a rock album, you know that, right?
Yeah. I mean, he was thinking of The Who. He was thinking of Tommy and Quadrophenia. Yeah. Well, they're not The Who. Come on.
They're not The Who.
You know? I mean, a great band, but they're not as good as The Who. Okay. Sorry. Definitely even back then. God. You know? Well, they've lasted as long as The Who, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But when the tour began, there was problems right off the bat. Townsend believed that to achieve the rich kind of overdubbed sounds of the album, because it is a very produced album.
I guess they're having a hard time doing the tour.
Well, to recreate that live, he wanted to bring a piano player, a guy named Chris Stainton, on.
Yeah.
Just to be on stage at all times. And Daltrey objected to this. He believed that there should only be the four Who members on stage at any given time. He didn't want to have like anybody else. So to obtain the kind of required instrumentation that you had to have to reproduce this, they decided to use backing tracks that were taped for the live performance. Now, they actually had experience doing this in the past, because on the Who's Next tour, they had backing tracks for Baba O'Reilly, which is, everybody knows it as Teenage Wasteland.
Yeah.
Okay. And the song Won't Get Fooled Again. Now, you know, there's a lot of that, okay, and the whole keyboard thing at the beginning of Baba O'Reilly.
Yeah.
That was when they did that live in those days. It was background tape. It was tape recorded. Now, They never did it, though, for a whole set, okay? So this was going to be, like, much more difficult than they had ever done before with these backing tapes. What happened a few times on Quadrophenia is the background tapes malfunctioned.
Oh, okay? Shit.
Yeah. They didn't work right. They didn't, you know, and then there were times they were not in time, especially at the beginning of the tour. that when they were finding it difficult to work within the constraints of the recording of the background tapes, they found it difficult. Now Moon, being this crazy ass drummer that really improvised so much of what he did, he had to play with what was called a click track, and drummers know what this is. Playing with a click track, you're not following the band, you're just playing, and you're stuck within that kind of mode, and that's a style of playing that he disliked. So it was very difficult for them to recreate this album and do it the way they wanted. Also, there was some inner tensions going on within the band. They were kind of like not prepared as far as rehearsals. They only had like really 2 days of rehearsals before they started the tour. Daltrey and Townsend at the second rehearsal got into an actual fight.
Yeah,
Daltrey popped Townsend in the face. Okay, and you know they were like, "Fuck it, we're not doing any more rehearsals. Let's just go out and do the tour." Okay, yeah. So they started that tour in England on October 28th, 1973, and the original plan was to play the entire album front to back, the way they did Tommy. Okay, but after the first gig at Stoke-on-Trent, the band dropped the song The Dirty Jobs, dropped Is It In My Head, and the song I've Had Enough from the set. Daltrey and Townsend felt that they had to explain way too much to the audience what was going on. You know, they would kind of explain to the audience the plot, all right? And a few shows later at Newcastle, the backing tapes for 5:15 came on too late, and Townsend freaks out. He grabs the sound technician in the middle of the show, curses him out, and kicks over his amp and throws all the backing tapes all over the stage and walks off. All right. Now, the whole band ended up leaving the stage for about 20 minutes, but they came back and just decided to play some older material for the audience. So there were some problems early on, especially in the British tour. The U.S. tour. Now, this is a classic story. The U.S. tour started November 20th in San Francisco at a place called the Cow Palace. And the group was very nervous about playing Quadrophenia with the backing tapes in the States. They really didn't want to have any problems in the United States because, you know, that would be very bad for their career, okay, to have these problems with the tour. So, right before the show, Keith Moon was hanging out backstage, and he was actually the one that was the most nervous out of the four.
Yeah.
And a fan who happened to be backstage offered him some tranquilizers. Now, if you know a little bit about Keith Moon, he basically was a vacuum cleaner for drugs and would take anything given to him. So he took a bunch of tranquilizers before the show. And right when the show started, that same fan collapsed because he had taken the pills as well and got sent to the hospital. Now, later on in the set, Moon started to kind of play erratically, and he couldn't keep up in time with the background tapes, and it was not going well, okay? So towards the end of the show, they were doing Won't Get Fooled Again. He got through the Quadrophenia set, but when they were doing Won't Get Fooled Again, he fell and passed out over the drum kit. Okay. Now, after 20 minutes, they gave him 20 minutes. He comes back and they start doing this song, Magic Bus, another older Who song. Okay.
Yeah.
He passes out again. Okay. Yeah. Right at the beginning of Magic Bus. He can't do it. They take him to the hospital. Now, there's a problem with the audience now, okay? The audience is starting to fucking freak out, okay? And a member in the audience, his name was Scott Halpin, big Who fan, and he was a musician in his own right. But he spoke to promoter Bill Graham, got his attention, and he said to him, "I can play the rest of the set." And he convinced Bill Graham, and Bill Graham told the band, "We got a guy that could do the show." because Mooney is out. Okay, he knows all the songs. So they let him do it. And I don't recall a time in history where there's been an audience member coming up on stage, at least a big show like that,
to finish
the set for the band. Okay. And that's a great, you know, little rock and roll moment. But Moon was okay. The next day was an off day for the band. So he was able to recover. And then they had a show at the L.A. Forum right after that. And he was at full strength and he was okay. The rest of the U.S. tour went well. They didn't have any more problems. They didn't have any more technical problems. No more drug problems. And the band got used to playing with the background tapes. So they were doing well. It was a successful U.S. tour, which they needed to have. In February of 74, the band did a short series of shows in France.
Yeah.
And the last show of those gigs was a place called Palais des Sports in, I guess it's pronounced Lyon or Lyon. And that's the 24th of February. And it turned out that that was the very last time Keith Moon would play, you know, Quadrophenia in full as a member of The Who, because he would pass away in 1978, unfortunately. Now, in June, flash forward many years, in June of 1996, Roger Daltrey, Pete Townsend, and John Entwistle, the three surviving members at that point, revived Quadrophenia as a live concert. They ended up performing at Hyde Park in London as part of what was called the Prince's Trust Masters of Music Benefit Concert.
Yeah.
They played most of the album, okay, and that was for the first time since 1974. The concert was not billed as The Who, but it was billed to the three individual members. Okay, they didn't call it The Who. But many special guests were brought in, including Gary Glitter. Okay, he was brought in to play The Godfather.
Yep.
Phil Daniels was Jimmy, and he was also the narrator. Now, Phil played Jimmy in the movie, okay?
Yep.
And a guy named Trevor McDonald, who was like a newscaster, he was the news reader in the show. You had Adrian Edmondson as the bellboy and Stephen Fry of Crying Game fame. He was the hotel manager. Zach Starkey, Ringo Starr's son, was on drums, and he's been playing with The Who for a long time now. David Gilmour from Pink Floyd played the bus driver as well. So what they did is they kind of like took the show on as a musical on the road. Okay, it wasn't really just a concert. They were bringing in characters that you saw in the movie and that were mentioned in the rock opera, and they had people play these characters like Gary Glitter. Okay, so the show itself was not without any problems though, because at rehearsal, Daltrey got hit with a mic stand, and then they had to do the show. When it was time to do the show, he had to wear an eye patch. So it seems like this show is a little cursed, right?
Yeah, definitely.
You know? Now, there was a subsequent tour right after that of the U.S. and the U.K. Billy Idol would replace Edmondson as the bellboy. Okay? Yeah. And I tried to get tickets for this. There was 85,000 tickets sold at Madison Square Garden over a six-night period in July of 1996. I tried to get tickets for this, man, and this was, you know, before the internet and when you were dealing with Ticketmaster and Ticketron and remember those days? You know, I couldn't get them, and I was so pissed because the very first concert I ever saw was The Who. All right, and that was in 1982 with The Clash opening up at Shea Stadium. And I've never seen them again. It's the only time I ever saw them. And in 96, now it's fucking 25 years ago already. Yeah. I wanted to see them again. And I remember being so disappointed I couldn't get tickets. And the scalper prices were through the roof. They were through the roof. I remember I had a couple of friends that had connections and they were like, look, you're talking like at least $500 a ticket. I didn't have that kind of money at the time. You know, so it was like, oh, well, I guess I'm not going to go see The Who.
Yeah, but, I remember that because I was doing baseball season. So that's like the year the Yankees won.
Right.
They were playing really good. And even to get tickets for the Yankee or get a concert ticket, MSG was hot that summer.
Yeah.
Dude, I'm sure you wanted to go there. They were like $400 or $500 to get Chicago tickets.
Yep. Yep. I know.
It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And sadly, because, you know, Entwistle would die in 2002 of a heart attack. So that would have been really the only time to see the three guys. Now, mm-hmm. when I saw them in 82, it was them. It was the three guys who Mooney had passed away in 78. So I didn't get to see them. But they had Kenny Jones on drums, and he was really good. But by 96, they had Zach Starkey. So it was like seeing a Beatles son. That would have been cool. But I never got to go. I regret that. I wish there was a way I could have went. But they would bring it back again between 2013. They did a few kind of one-off Quadrophenia shows. And also Townsend himself in 2017 would embark on a short tour with just an orchestra entitled Classic Quadrophenia. So I've seen these clips online. It's kind of interesting. And they recently played, I think it was right before the pandemic, they played Forest Hill Stadium, but it wasn't Quadrophenia. It was just Daltrey and Townsend. And I've seen some of these later shows online, and I don't know. I love Roger, but his voice ain't cutting it no more.
Nah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I hate to say that because he really had one of the best voices in rock, you know, but it's okay. What are you going to do? He's still Roger Daltrey. Now, you can't talk about the album without mentioning a little bit about the film, okay? The film came out in 1979, and it was directed by a guy named Frank Rodham. The film did a fantastic job giving kind of a visual interpretation of what Pete Townsend's vision was of Jimmy and Jimmy's life and the goings on, okay? Now, Phil Daniels, like I mentioned before, was the actor that played Jimmy. He was like 19 years old. Sting from The Police played Ace Face, okay? And unlike Tommy, the movie Tommy, the music was more in the background of the film. It just was like scenes. You would hear music from Quadrophenia, other songs by The Who. There was other music in the movie from the time of the early 60s of the Mods and the Rockers. Okay. Nobody in the, you know, the cast members in the movie didn't sing anything. It wasn't like a musical like Tommy. Okay. Anne Margaret sings in Tommy and, you know, other people in that film. Tina Turner has a great scene in Tommy as singing the song Acid Queen, which was on the, you know, the Who album. So this was done more seriously like a film. And I saw a clip with Frank Rodden talking about, and I totally agree with what he was saying. The idea was they really wanted to create something very realistic of the time, okay, that early 60s mods period and the violence and the drugs and stuff like that. And they really do get it down. I heard that they used, like, there's a scene when, if you remember the scene when there's the big riot on Brighton Beach, and the Mods and the Rockers are all fighting, and the police are clubbing everybody. And Jimmy and Ace end up getting arrested. And when they get to the courtroom, Ace is standing in the docket, and the judge is reaming him, you know, and he's speaking in a very almost archaic English language, okay, like words that they don't use anymore, okay. It was supposed to, you know, and they actually used the language from cases that they looked up in the past, in the records of what happened in those days, what judges had said to them and stuff like that, you know, how you're not going to amount to anything and you better change your life and, you know, stuff like that. And the great scene about that in the movie is right when the judge is reaming him. You know, he says, and the judge says, and you're going to be fined £75. So Ace worked as a bellboy. He had money, he had a few bucks. And he goes, oh, you know, would you like me to pay this now? He goes, do you have a pen? He pulls out a checkbook. And it's just kind of like all the mods go nuts because he's paying his fine and sticking it to him, you know, right there.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's a great scene. Now, the soundtrack to the film had three new songs in which the new Who drummer at the time, Kenny Jones, had made his debut. Okay, and you could hear those songs in the movie, mostly towards the end, I believe, of the film. The film was a commercial and a critical success. It did very well and actually coincided with the mod revival that was kind of happening in the UK in the late 70s. Jam, okay?
Yep.
You know, the Jam were at the forefront of that mod revival going on. So it really was a very timely movie in the UK, and it harkened back to the original era of the early 60s. So that's all I got for you, Rob. Quadrophilia.
That was fantastic, man. So much information. It's such a, you know, such a good episode. It's such a great album. And definitely, people check out the film. I'm going to put links to where you can find the film and stuff like that. And put links to the album, too, because you could probably listen to this album on Spotify and everything else.
Well, if you want to see the movie, Amazon Prime has it for $3.85. Okay.
Is that to buy or to rent?
To rent. Okay. It's worth $3, believe me.
Yeah. I'll probably do that a little later today and watch
it. Yeah, yeah. It's the only thing with the film, and of course, being an American only, we would say something like this. The accents in the movie are very difficult to understand. Okay, you have to like really pay attention to the movie because, you know, the street language of these British guys are like very, very strong. So,
yeah.
You know, there's movies. I wonder if you could put a subtitle on it. You might be able to. I didn't even think of that.
Oh, you might be. Yeah, you might be able. So, Mike, I just want to say, our friend Richard Manitoba is playing Barry Electric, I think, July 31st.
Yeah, yeah, July 31st. And I think by the time we have this up, though, I think it'll be done, right? Maybe we'll go there.
Yeah, maybe go there. That's what I'm talking about. So, because this show is probably be up in August, but yeah, Manitoba. I just wanted to put that
yeah,
out there.
Yeah.
And, let's see if we can get some tickets and go.
Yep. We got to talk to him.
All right.
All right, man.
All right, Mike. So, where can we find you?
Okay, I'm out there all over the place. You can find me on Instagram under RockerMike212. You could find me on MeWe and Clout Hub under Rocker Mike. You could find me on Facebook under Rocko Mike. And also the Rock Show podcast group page. I've also signed up on Getter, GETTR, which is the new type of Twitter that's out there under Rocker Mike. But I'm just kind of using that for commentary right now. So I'm not sure if you want to check that out because I got some fucked up opinions about shit. So, you know, but definitely look for me on Facebook and Instagram and MeWe and Cloud Hub. Rocker Mike.
And on Facebook, it's Rocko Mike.
Rocko Mike, yes. They won't let me be Rocker Mike on Facebook. You believe that?
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. Where can we find you, Rob?
And you can find me on any social media platform. Just look, Getting Lumped Up, and you'll see my big head come up, and you know that you find it.
And it is a big head.
Yep. And pretty much that's all that we got for you guys today. I hope you enjoyed the show. Mike did an excellent job, like always, in giving us all this information. And remember, people,
don't get drunk.
Get lumped up. See you next week.
Take care, people.
Podcast you will hear that will be music to your ears. You'll learn about bands you love or may not know, and it's only here on the Rock Show. Get lumped up on the Rock Show.